You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about how the Great Lakes are forecast to hit record high water levels this summer. Right now, it's time for our weekly state news roundup. We're checking in with reporters from around the state about the stories they've been covering. First, city officials in Wisconsin Rapids advanced a proposed ordinance this week that would allow parents to be held accountable when their children are involved in some cases of bullying. Jamie Rokas is the community engagement editor at the Wisconsin Rapids Tribune and the Marshfield News Herald. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, if this were put into practice, what exactly would this ordinance do?
Well, the ordinance has a couple of steps. One is it prohibits bullying or harassment, and it also prohibits retaliation against people who report bullying and harassment. But the part that has raised the most questions and the most concern among people in the city is that there's also a penalty for parents of minors who are involved in bullying situations. And that penalty for a first offense would be $50, and with additional court costs and fees, that total comes to $313.
And I understand, Jamie, this was motivated in large part by one particular incident. Can you talk about that?
I can. Earlier this year, it was in the middle of February, there was a social media post that included notes that had been written to a seventh grade girl at Wisconsin Rapids Area Middle School. And the content of these notes was very alarming to parents. The handwritten notes were given to her at school by students she didn't know who they were. And they called her names, told her she was stupid, and told her to end her life and how to do that. So parents were very alarmed, and so was the school, after those notes were made public.
And I understand this would not be the first type of ordinance like this. There are other communities in the state that have done this?
There are. Clover, Wisconsin started, adopted a similar ordinance about 4 years ago, and they say it's been very successful. Grand Rapids, which is just adjacent to Wisconsin Rapids, approved a similar ordinance in early April. And there's other ones around the state in Monona as well as Shawano.
Do we know in those communities if they've assessed a lot of fines or if the idea is just to say, hey, parents, wake up, you could be held accountable?
Well, that's what's really interesting. In Clover, they said they actually have not issued any fines. They have issued about a dozen written warnings to parents, which is kind of the first step in most cases. And that's what Wisconsin Rapids and their police department is hoping to do as well, to kind of use this as a tool to make parents aware that their students are involved in a bullying situation. And they actually hope, in most cases, to never have to issue that fine to parents, you know, to resolve that situation first.
And as we wrap up, Jamie, what is the timeline for when we'll find out if this will go into effect in Wisconsin Rapids?
The next meeting of the full Common Council will be on June 18th, and it will be brought up again there.
Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Jamie Rokas, Community Engagement Editor at the Wisconsin Rapids Tribune. She talked with us about a proposed ordinance in the city that could hold parents accountable if their children are involved in bullying. Now, the Unified School District of Antigo is closing three of its elementary schools, Pleasant View, Spring Valley, and Crestwood, joining other districts around the state in consolidating their facilities. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural community reporter. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, tell us the story about why the school district is deciding to close these three schools.
So this is, as you say, this is a familiar story, right? This is a district, the Unified School District of Antigo, has had declining enrollment from a peak of more than 3,000 kids in the mid-90s to this year, 2,300 or so. And when you have declining enrollments, you have fiscal challenges. And so, like a lot of districts, is looking for ways to consolidate and save money on buildings. And as a result, these three rural schools that are outside of like Antigo city limits were the ones that were chosen to be closed.
You, Rob, talked with some of the fourth graders yesterday at Pleasant View Elementary about their favorite memories there. You shared with us a listen to what some of them had to say.
One of my favorite memories was racing my friends through the deep snow this winter.
When we were doing hovercraft, playing football with my friends every day.
When we got to launch straw rockets in the gym.
When I was on the girls' basketball team.
So how were the kids feeling about the idea of their school closing down, Rob?
So, you know, for these fourth graders, I think that the prospect of summer looms rather large, and it may not sink into them. But, you know, I talked to a parent who herself went to the Spring Valley School. Her father and her uncle went to the same school, and her three kids went there. And I think, you know, people have an emotional relationship to these places. And so people sort of understand. Look, I think this source certainly did, and other sources I spoke to certainly understand the reason behind this. And yet, you know, there's a lot that gets imbued in an elementary school building. And, you know, you grow up there, kids grow up there and learn. And there's something sad about being there on the last couple days of school here.
Can you talk about other schools, especially in smaller towns or rural areas, that have made or are making similar decisions?
Yeah, so I have been trying to track down some sort of some quantities on this, and it's a bit hard to do. What do you define as a rural school? And there are a lot of, you know, the Oshkosh School District just this week voted to close a school district, and close an elementary school. It's within city limits. It's just a really old building, and so it closes. I looked at, you know, here nearby to Antigo, Merrill had closed, Pine River Elementary and another rural school. Wisconsin Rapids last year closed their Vesper Elementary School. And this is a sign of the times. This is just the way it is, I guess, as populations decline in a lot of these areas. There was a high profile piece in the New York Times about a year ago profiling the closure of the only school in the town of Arena, Wisconsin, that really looked at some of the larger forces behind it and also some of the emotions that the communities experience.
And we're at state budget time, of course. The school budget looms large in there. Do you see that as something that might help schools avoid future closures, or is this just a demographic trend that there's not really a budget fix for?
Well, there is budget matters. And you know, Antigo is like a lot of school districts in the state that have gone to referendum in recent years. Voters in 2016 voted against a referendum that involved the closure of schools as well as some other new renovations of other sites. Someone that I talked to said she thought maybe one reason people voted against was they thought, well, if we vote against this, maybe they won't close the schools, and it doesn't really work that way. But like, without a doubt, this is driven by schools that look at their balance sheets and try to figure out how to, you know, where they can save money, and more money from the state certainly would be a factor. It may not completely overrule the demographic trends, but certainly it would be a factor.
Rob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, WPR's Rural Communities reporter. He filled us in on the Antigo School District's decision to close three of its elementary schools. Finally, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley is planning to demolish one of his three residences, a mansion in Shorewood that he purchased last December. The move is getting pushback from local residents who say the mansion has historic significance. Dan Bice is the watchdog columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Can you talk, Dan, about the reaction that Abley's decision is getting from his new neighbors?
Well, the village of Shorewood says that the opposition to his plans running about 90% to 10%. People just are very upset that he wouldn't have disclosed this before now. He put in an application to demolish the house. He bought the house in December of last year, and now he's planning to do this and to put up his own house on this property. We should stipulate this is like a first world problem. Mm-hmm. This isn't a major issue or problem, but it is true that the people in Shorewood are very upset about this.
Now, this building, I think you wrote it, dates back to the 1920s. People use the adjective historic, but in a legal sense, it does not have historic protections, right?
Right. There's a famous architect here, Alexander Eschweiler, who designed it. It's a very interesting design. It's built around an organ of one of the E-lines had the house and had him build the house. There's an organ in there with pipes in the ceiling and in the basement. 1927. It is from the outside. It looks like a lovely house. And everyone seems to agree, you know, he's bought the property. There are no protections. So he has the right to do with it as he pleases. But the people of Shorewood are asking the question, is what he wants to do right for the community?
So what kind of things are people in the area, given that they have no real recourse here, what kind of things are they doing to try to protest this, I guess?
Well, there's an online petition opposing this. Many of them showed up at the last village board meeting for Shorewood. This is a very popular topic on social media. But I wrote a piece today saying it looks like he's going to be able to get to do what he wants because Shorewood has no laws or ordinances about historic preservation. So the best they could do is to send him a letter to tell him not to do what he's planning to do. And they even voted that down 4-3 earlier this week. So, you know, there's pushback, but it doesn't look like there's any legal recourse to stop him from what he's planning to do. The biggest question politically is, why does he do this now? He's up for re-election in April. As you said, starting off this whole discussion, he's got two other places to live here. He has actually the largest house in Milwaukee, which sits vacant at 3319 North Lake Drive. And he lives in the Modern condo, which is he's bought several of the condos, torn out the walls, very large place. But he's decided to move ahead with this now. He doesn't have any opposition, but there are a lot of people online saying I'll never vote for him again as a result of this controversy.
And in the meantime, people can maybe get a piece of this house. It's already being stripped and things are going to Habitat for Humanity's Restore. Is that right?
That's right. They have three restores, and all of this stuff is going to the Wauwatosa Restore. They've taken out windows. They've taken out doors. They've taken out a lot of stuff, and all you have to do is go to the Restore in Tosa, and you can buy any of that stuff.
I don't want to make light of it, but does anybody have dibs on the organ yet?
I don't think it's been removed because of the way it's set up, but again, I'm no organ specialist. The former owners of the house say this is a very important and special organ. It's currently not working, though, because it was flooded and so forth. But if you want to buy it, you're going to have to fix it.
Dan, thanks a lot for getting us up to speed on this.
Sure. Thank you very much.
That's Dan Bice, watchdog columnist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked about a controversial decision by Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley to demolish one of his homes in Shorewood, as we heard, raising some concerns among his neighbors and members of that community. He finishes up our weekly roundup of news stories around Wisconsin with the people who are covering them. Coming up, Great Lakes water levels are expected to hit record highs throughout this summer. We'll find out why and what it means for people who live and vacation on the lakes. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some 2020 presidential candidates are starting to talk about ways to deal with a lack of affordable housing around the United States. We'll take a closer look at what's driving rising housing costs and some proposals to tackle the problem. First, a few of the Great Lakes are going to reach their highest water levels ever recorded. That's according to the latest forecast from the Army Corps of Engineers, which gathers data from a variety of sources and updates their predictions regularly. Keith Kompaltowicz is Chief of Watershed Hydrology for the Corps of Engineers in Detroit. Keith, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Happy to be with you.
Well, now we have this new data from the month of May. Can you break down the major findings for Great Lake levels?
Yeah, we have record high water levels for the month of May. We're reached on Lake Superior, Lake St. Clair, and Lake Erie. And while the other two lakes, Lakes Michigan Huron and Lake Ontario, didn't quite reach record levels, they were the highest since 1986 on Lakes Michigan Huron, which was the record back then. So this is the second highest recorded for May, and We're still looking at the potential for more record highs as we go into the summer.
What's driving these high lake levels?
It's just been extremely wet across the Great Lakes Basin over the last several years even. We can trace this back even back to 2013 and 2014 when we started to see more active storm tracks bring much more snow to the Great Lakes Basin in the winter, follow that up with extremely heavy rainfall in the spring. And that brought the lakes back from very low and even record low levels to average, and then that trend continued over the past couple of years, and we're at record highs essentially now.
You project out, you try to predict about 6 months at a time. What are you looking at as you make those projections into the future?
Yeah, our forecast is a six-month product, and we look at very closely the current conditions in the system, you know, how much rain has recently fallen, what the stream flows and all the tributaries that feed the lakes are running, if they're running high or low. We try to get a handle on the best weather forecasts for at least the short term, and then we look at projections from our federal counterparts at the Weather Service for longer-term weather patterns to try to hone in where we think the lakes will head to based on all of that information.
We know we have these high levels now. Sounds like they're likely to stick around for a while. What does this mean for people living on the lakes, vacationing, and for people who have to deal with management of resources along the lake shores?
Yeah, so when we get to these high water level situations, we're certainly dealing with increases in coastal flooding, especially when we get strong onshore winds or storm systems move through. We also see incidents of coastal erosion, and that erosion is now occurring higher up on the shoreline and can, come very close to structures and people's homes. So the people that live along the lakes are certainly watching this very closely. If you're going to visit one of our many Great Lakes beaches this summer, you're likely to see smaller beaches as the water lines have come up significantly in the past couple of years.
We're talking about high water levels in the Great Lakes. Keith Kompaldowitz is with us, Chief of Watershed Hydrology for the Army Corps of Engineers in Detroit. Keith, how swingy are water levels over time from year to year? How much variability do we tend to see?
Well, on Lake Michigan and Huron, which we consider to be one lake because they're joined at the Straits of Mackinac, the range between the record high and the record low was about 6 feet. And then our period of record goes back to 1918. So just up until, very recently, that 6 foot range has been, where the lake has fluctuated over the last 100 years.
And how about the bigger lakes? We're obviously here in Wisconsin. We're really interested in Lakes Superior in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Lake Superior has a slightly lower range. But again, its period of record goes back to 1918. So we have 100 years of water levels to study and look at. And up until recently, the levels have fluctuated within that range. Again, that goes back to 1918.
Are things getting more swingy over time, if swingy is an acceptable technical word?
Sure, yeah. We've definitely seen from our long stretch of low water levels that began in the late 1990s and continued right up until 2013, 14, 15 time, depending on the lake, we saw a very quick 24-month rise on Lake Superior and Michigan Huron, some of the fastest 24-month rises in that period of record. So in terms of how quickly we went from very low and record low even to average and now above average, that isn't repeated very often in that period of record.
That seems like a management challenge in and of itself, not just the lakes are really low or the lakes are really high, but that they switched, as you say, in a two-year span that quickly.
Yeah, I think that did catch some folks off guard, especially when a lot of the folks in the academic community and research communities were kind of alluding to the fact that low water was here to stay. Low water was the new norm. And then, the switch was turned essentially to where the lake started rising very quickly. And certainly we understand why that occurred, and that's just the how wet and how active the storm track has been over the Great Lakes over the past couple of years.
With any story like this, people might be wondering, is there an observable impact of climate change at this point? How do you factor in, if at all, climate change into your past observations and then into these, I guess, six-month outlooks?
Sure. We focus really on what's happening right now. And we have a very good understanding of the reasons why lake levels have risen substantially in the past couple of years. And that's because of that increase in precipitation, increase in runoff, snowfall during the winter, and that drove the lake levels up. we tend to focus on that rather than, you know, investigating the climate change angle, because we really have a good understanding of what's happening right now.
Keith, I've never lived on a Great Lake, but I've spent a lot of time on various lakes over the years. Would a layperson be able to observe this kind of difference, the kind of swings we saw, as you said, from those record lows to these record highs standing on the same piece of lake shore on Lake Superior, Michigan, you name it?
I certainly think so, especially the folks that are, you know, are living on the lakes. We've received numbers of pictures, you know, taken from the same vantage point, even from 1 month to the next, and the change in the water line at their beach or at their home or at their dock is very noticeable, especially seeing from the same pictures from when we were at very low water levels.
Are cities, local governments, even residents starting to look at lake levels and try to take into account the variability as we build stuff?
I think so. The Corps certainly has been involved locally here in Michigan with several communities, advising them on what they may be able to do to protect infrastructure and protect homes and generally protect the shoreline. So I think that's certainly being done, and the Corps of Engineers, through its certain authorities, and is available to help under certain circumstances.
Keith, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
That's Keith Kompaltowicz, Chief of Watershed Hydrology for the Corps of Engineers in Detroit. We talked to him about their latest report on rising water levels around the Great Lakes. Coming up, we'll look at some proposals from Democratic presidential candidates to deal with housing affordability problems around the country for people who buy homes and who rent them. You can join in with the situation where you are. Are you seeing rents going up? Is it possible for you to afford a house? Let us know right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joins the show with his take on the latest developments in the state budget. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Also on Monday, Wisconsin marks the 100th anniversary of the state ratifying the 19th Amendment, which ultimately allowed many American women to vote. There will be some festivities to mark the event at the state capitol. I talked to Governor Tony Evers and First Lady Kathy Evers yesterday evening. Here's the First Lady talking about the celebration at the capitol.
We're going to have lots of fun storytelling events and photo opportunities, and we've got our speakers, and they're going to unveil the original 19th Amendment, too, which is going to be fantastic. It's going to be on display for from 12 o'clock until 10 o'clock. So we're hoping lots of people will be interested in seeing that original document.
You can hear more of that interview Monday on Central Time. The celebration kicks off Monday at noon at the state capitol. Now, people across the country are continuing to feel the squeeze from high housing costs. And now a number of Democratic presidential contenders are putting forward plans to address the issue. Andra Gent joins us now for a look at the issue of housing affordability. She is an associate professor of real estate and urban land economics with the UW-Madison School of Business. Andra, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, how big of a problem do you see housing affordability being across the United States right now?
I think everybody agrees that this is a huge problem. It's been growing in importance for a number of years, and I think that we're now sort of recognizing that we have to tackle it in a more direct fashion. So I think it is a huge problem, and I'm actually really happy to hear a number of presidential candidates talking about the issue.
Before we get into their approaches to tackling this plan, I think a lot of times when people think high housing costs, they think of particular big cities, San Francisco, parts of New York City, Seattle, where there are just rapidly escalating housing costs. But we've also talked on this show about rural Wisconsin facing housing affordability problems. This is across a lot of different communities, right?
Yeah, it is very widespread. It's obviously it's especially prevalent in some of these very supply constrained cities. You know, the constraints in Wisconsin are not necessarily that we can't build more housing. It's more that the cost of building housing has gone up, and we don't see as much as you can't build rental housing for the same price as you used to be able to. And of course, the new tariffs are only going to make this worse, as I'm sure you're imagining. The other thing that's sort of changed is the rise in inequality, and this has been going on for, 30 or 40 years, but particularly in the central business district, sort of as you go out from downtown areas in cities like certainly Madison and Milwaukee, you're bidding, everybody's bidding for the same space, right? And whether you earn $20,000 a year or $200,000 a year, people are bidding on essentially the same thing. So if you can't build more of it, a rise in inequality means that the bottom half of the income distribution is more constrained. And so I just want to be clear that when we talk about the housing affordability problem, we're primarily talking about a rental income problem. It's not really I don't think people are spending more on owner-occupied housing. It's primarily rental, and primarily in the bottom half of the income distribution of renters.
And I've seen a case made that there's a trickle-over effect, I guess. Those people who are paying more for rent are therefore not able to save up that down payment if and when they do want to buy a house.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned renting, and a lot of the Democratic platforms on housing are addressing renting. Is it fair to say that most federal policy over the years is focused on the homeowner, not the renter?
Absolutely. We have had decades of policies focused on housing affordability for owner-occupiers. And we have, literally hundreds of billions of dollars of federal tax credits going to homeowners. So the mortgage interest deduction, not having to pay capital gains on your primary residence, not having the imputed rent of your own home tax. These are all benefits that have accrued to homeowners, and homeowners tend to come from the top 2/3 of the income distribution. And yet we've had much less attention paid to rental housing. Now we have had some federal programs to support building rental programs, but it's clear that those aren't deep enough. And certainly the voucher program, which is the biggest federal program, as some of your listeners may know, that doesn't reach nearly as many people as they're eligible. And so there really just isn't enough supply. So what I see with some of these, particularly Senator Booker's program, is basically it's an expansion of the voucher program. It turns a voucher program, which was used to be something you might or might not be able to get, into an entitlement. That's how I see parts of these plans. Similarly with Senator Harris's plan.
Talking to Andra Gent right now, Associate Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison School of Business, looking at rental problems in the United States, rent costs going up in many communities, lack of availability in a lot of places too, and Democratic presidential candidates starting to release platforms on how they want to tackle that. You mentioned that idea of the renters tax credits, part of Senator Booker's plan and others. One concern people raise is, okay, if you have these credits for people, they can afford to pay a little more for housing, well then maybe landlords are just going to bump up their prices that much. There's not really a savings for people. How does this tend to play out in practice?
Yeah, so that's a very legitimate concern. And it's an especially legitimate concern in California, where if you're not building new supply, the net effect is it all gets reflected in higher rent. Now, a couple thoughts on this. So it really depends on the supply elasticity. I think Wisconsin's a little bit better on that front. Even if that's true, I think these expansion, what I see these as a lot of expansion of a voucher program into an entitlement program. Some of it, I think, is an implicit income redistribution program. So we often have some resistance to income redistribution programs. But I think this is, even if it raises rents overall, if you're redistributing income to the lowest third of the income distribution, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
What are some other policies that you see being proposed by candidates that that tackle different angles on the rental problem?
Yeah, so I think that both Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker's plans have elements of tackling the supply issue of how do we get more supply. And I'm really happy to hear that they're talking about local zoning restrictions and building codes. And these are some of the biggest. If you talk to any developer, you know, why can't you build affordable housing? And they'll cite a couple of things, is that it just takes so long to get it through the paperwork. And that's something that cities create. Cities create barriers to developing housing, and they have the ability to reduce these barriers. Now, I don't know how successful. The devil is in sort of in the details. And so we need to see what the details are of how they're going to tackle these zoning restrictions. But that would be the hope, that we see them actually provide some incentives to cities I'm not sure how much sway the federal government has over cities, but I like that we're talking about it. We're acknowledging that cities are creating a lot of their own problems in terms of resisting affordable housing. And oftentimes it's a little bit of a not in my backyard thing, where it's like, okay, well, maybe Middleton shouldn't do it. Maybe we need more affordable housing, but maybe it's not Middleton. Maybe it should be Sun Prairie. You know, it's somewhere else. It's always somebody else's problem.
Right. And this is something that seems to be replicated in community after community, wealthier or at least middle class and up residents who may have a bit more political sway might be resistant to the idea of changing the zoning that allows more affordable housing, maybe rental units in their neighborhoods. This is something we see around the country.
Yeah. You know, and I see it even we definitely see it around the country, but I see it even in Austin. Certain buildings that like to be owner-occupied, you know, they get very resistant to the idea that there might be renters in the building, too. So I think everybody has some resistance to it. But the municipalities do have the power of saying, we're not going to enforce minimum lot sizes. We're going to allow heights. We're going to allow you to build to a certain height. We're not going to, some of the other things are allow what sort of bedrooms. You know, one of the things that would really help is, right now, most developers, if they're building multifamily, they're going to build one bedroom, one bath. And what we really need to start seeing is a two bedroom to one bath. In that affordable segment, we really need kind of lower construction costs. And so the question is sort of how do you incentivize that? And some of it is through the unit mix. There's a number of things that cities can do, but the zoning restrictions are a really good place to start. Just allow. So that's sort of a market solution where you just allow developers to build highest and best use. In many cases, that's going to be multifamily.
We're talking to Andra Gent of UW-Madison School of Business. We're talking about affordable housing in the United States and what's driving high rents in communities around Wisconsin and around the country, and what some Democratic presidential candidates are putting on the table to try to tackle that problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where you live, are the rents too darn high? Do you have trouble finding affordable housing for yourself, a place you can afford to stay? Is housing a big piece of your budget puzzle? If you are in local government or if you're a developer, definitely love to hear your perspective on this, your experience on why we do or don't have affordable rental units in your part of the state. And is this something you want to see presidential candidates talking about? And what do you think of the plans we've heard about so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about an affordable housing, what some people are calling crisis in the United States, and some proposals we're seeing from 2020 presidential candidates to deal with the issue, especially when it comes to rentals. Andra Gent is with us from the Real Estate and Urban Land Economics Program at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are things like in your part of the state when it comes to affordable housing, a place you can afford to rent. Do you think elected officials at the local, state, or federal levels are paying enough attention? Do you have a question for our guest? And is this an issue that affects the work you do? If you're in local government or if you're a developer, what do you see as a reason that there might not be affordable housing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andra, another part of U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren's plan when it comes to housing has to do with taking on discrimination, racial discrimination in particular in housing. What kind of things are we seeing out there in 2019?
Yeah, so, I mean, this has been something we've been working on for a very long time, and we have a number of policies in place in the mortgage market to prevent it. And overall, in the mortgage market, I think we're doing a pretty good job. That's my sense. It may still exist on some level, but it's small. And so we've really, I think that's a success of federal policy on mortgage market discrimination overall. And again, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying it's small and is not super frequent. On the rental side, you know, audit studies, so this is often when you either use a name that is more associated with African-American households, or you send an actor in that's African-American or white, and you basically look at how the landlords respond, and there's still a lot of discrimination in the rental market. So I liked, I don't know exactly, again, the details, we need to see some details on this. One of the elements of Elizabeth Warren's policy I like is down payment assistance for minority households. I like that because what we know is that underrepresented minority households tend to have less wealth for the same income. So you can go to college, you can get a good job, you work hard, and yet we're still not seeing these underrepresented minorities build a lot of wealth. And a lot of that is that it's an intergenerational thing. My concern, though, and this is why I'm sort of hesitant to endorse it without seeing a bit more on the details front, is that we need to be very careful that homeownership is the right choice for some households. So one of the things, you know, the viewers that are my age or older will remember the financial crisis, and affordable housing policy was not to blame for it. I want to make that 100% clear. One of the things that we did see was a narrative where regulators didn't maybe clamp down on what they saw in the mortgage market. And part of it was, well, these products are helping low income and minority households become homeowners. And unfortunately, a lot of people did become homeowners and subsequently lost their homes within, you know, a few years. And that was not a positive experience. So I just want to be very careful about what is this going to look like, because we know people default on their mortgages when they don't have a stake in it. And so if this is so I just I need to see the details on this, but I appreciate her considering the matter.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I work for a major, and I'm talking a very major window company. And so we deliver all Wisconsin, UP, Illinois. And I don't see any affordable housing going up. Every house that we deliver to, and we deliver to new builds, is always at least $1 million. Well, actually, I shouldn't say $1 million. At least $300,000 and up. So, I mean, I can't afford a $300,000 house. My house is $150,000. And like I said, my windows are extremely expensive. So, I mean, and we see farm fields all the time are becoming subdivisions. And like I said, the houses are never under $300,000. So, how can anybody afford that?
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And I've seen an argument back and forth over the years, Andra, on this. One along Nick's side, hey, we're building expensive houses. We're not building affordable stuff. Other people say, well, hold on, there's a trickle-down effect. Wealthier people will buy these more expensive places that takes the demand and pressure off of the houses that they might have bought otherwise. What do you see when it comes to what kind of housing we're building?
Yeah, so I think there is some element, we call it filtering, where there is always, you know, when you build new expensive homes, I'm glad you brought that up, then it does, the older housing stock will filter down a little bit. I mean, overall, new supply is always going to bring down housing prices. That's just sort of a fact. So we always like new supply. There's often one of the things that people often get confused about is they see neighborhoods where a bunch of new expensive housing goes up, and they say this is the cause of why housing is getting expensive in this neighborhood. And usually the causality is the reverse. The developer picks a neighborhood because land values are rising, and then they put the sort of housing because they see who's moving into the neighborhood. So people often get that a little bit mixed up in the causality. You know, then the question, okay, so if we did want to change the mix of units, then I think that you need to provide some incentives. And this is usually at the local level. You know, I don't know how much the federal government can really do about it. At least historically, they have not gone into these sort of details where you say, you know, I only want in this, we're going to zone as residential two is going to be a minimum of this or maximum square footage of this sort of unit, and you get into really the details of the unit mix, or you know, lot size. That often, you know, it's a big lot usually if you're going to put a $300,000 house on it. But I think you really need to talk to the developers and sort of say, hey, what are your barriers? Why is it not financially feasible for you to build affordable housing? And then you need to, once you've heard from that, you need to sort of say, okay, what incentives can we provide if it's important to us? What sort of incentives can we provide to make them build smaller homes or lower cost construction materials? You know, one thing I think that's really important to think about is zoning more mobile home parks. That's actually a super affordable way of housing people, and yet many cities are very resistant to zoning more mobile home parks. But that's a very affordable way of housing people.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Why are cities resistant to that idea of mobile home parks?
You know, I think they have sometimes they're manufactured homes, you know, modular homes, sometimes they go by the name of. I think that, you know, it's a very good question. I think they have a stigma associated with them. I know there's been something like 20 zoned in the last like 30 years or something across the entire country. So I think there's a stigma and people don't want that. I think it's a concentration of low income housing. But I think that also, I mean, things have changed. The type of housing you can get in a trailer park now, the quality is pretty good. I hesitate to use the word trailer park because that's what's been stigmatized. But you can build fairly high quality housing at a very affordable price. And so I would like to see cities consider zoning a whole lot more of these. That would be another thing I think that they may want to consider.
Andrea, in our last minute or so, do you see policymakers from the local to the federal level starting to maybe wake up and switch gears some when it comes to this issue of high rental costs?
Yeah, I think they are. And I think it's good we're talking about this on the federal stage. You know, I think it's really important, and I know in a lot of Wisconsinites are very engaged with their local policymakers because I think these are primarily local levels. And the national political debates often get a lot of the media attention, but I think what can tackle these problems most effectively is often local policies. But I think across the nation we're getting more and more attention on this issue because it is a nationwide issue, even if a lot of the solutions might come from the local level.
Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That's Andrea Gent, Associate Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison's School of Business. She was with us today to look at the affordable housing problems across the United States when it comes to affordable rent in particular, and now some solutions being offered by 2020 presidential contenders. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new survey says many Americans are worried about fake or misleading news these days, but it can be hard for people to agree on a definition of what that all means. A media expert joins us for a look at fake news, public opinion, and how we sort those out. We'll dig deep into the world of conspiracy theories and why people are often drawn in by them. We'll meet the author of the new book, Republic of Lies. And the governor and first lady of Wisconsin joined the show to mark the 100-year anniversary of Wisconsin ratifying the 19th Amendment, which opened up the vote to many women across the country. Wisconsin had been a slow starter, it turns out, in state-led efforts to allow women to vote. But Wisconsin ended up being the first state to successfully ratify the 19th Amendment. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 6:15, it's June, and it's time to break out the sunscreen. Kate talks to a dermatologist about some of the myths and realities of summertime skincare and the hazards of long-term sun damage. That's Monday at 6:15 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn more about Appalachian cuisine on this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Smoke, Roots, Mountain Harvest, Recipes and Stories from My Appalachian Home. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.